Tonight we're going to go through the Northern Kings first, and then the Southern Kings. And I can see everybody is really pleased with the new seating arrangement.
No. Like the space between the rows.
We can do that. We can make a little more space. The first king and the north, and keep in mind as we give these are parallel in chronological time. Even though we're going to go through all the ones for the north first, the ones from the south was taking place at the same time because the United Kingdom had split, and this was the group. The first king for the north was Jeroboam, and June, would you mind coming up here and giving us your report?
June, look at this.
Well, I was just following trees.
Oh, I didn't see my.
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm Jeroboam the First of Israel. I hear those hisses and jeers. I know what you're thinking. Evil. And you're right. 19 times Scripture calls me the man who caused Israel to sin. The 18 kings who followed me, 15 are described as acting like Jeroboam, who made Israel to sin. Do an aside, the handout I gave you doesn't necessarily follow along with what I'm doing. I did a different thing on the oral, so saw a little bit of confusion. Okay, but it wasn't always that way. Let me tell you my story, how I started out really with God's approval, and then I spiraled to the depths of sin. It all began when the Lord became angry with Solomon, because Solomon's heart turned away from the Lord. And the Lord raised up many adversaries against him. And I, Jeroboam of Ephraim, son of Nebat, an official of Solomon's, was one of those adversaries that the Lord raised up. So here's what happened. Solomon was building the supporting terraces and filling in the gaps in the wall in Jerusalem. And he was using conscripted labor from all the tribes of Israel. And he saw me working, and he was really impressed with the way that I worked. And he put me in charge of the whole labor force of the house of Joseph. And it was at this time that I became aware of the harshness of the work and the discontent of the people. So when I was going out of Jerusalem, when my tribe had finished its stint there in the workforce, Ahijah, the prophet of Shiloh, met me alone out in the country. He was wearing a new cloak, and he took it and he shredded it into 12 pieces. And he told me, take 10 pieces for yourself. For the God of Israel says, I'm going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hands and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of David, Solomon will have one tribe. And that was the tribe of Judah with the tribe of Simeon, which was included within its boundaries. God would do this to Solomon because he had turned to foreign gods and not walked with him in his ways. However, God would allow Solomon to rule until his death and would take the 10 tribes away from his son. One tribe would remain so that David, God's servant, would always have a lamp in Jerusalem. And God said that I would be king of Israel. I did what he commanded and walked in his ways. He would be with me and build a dynasty as enduring as David's dynasty. God also said he would humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever. remember that his promise to David was an eternal promise. Oh, if I'd only remembered God's promises. But Solomon must have gotten wind of the prophecy because he sent people out to kill me. So I fled to Egypt, and I went under the sanctuary of King Shishak of Egypt. After Solomon's death, I returned and was summoned to go with the whole assembly of Israel's tribes to the coronation of Rehoboam, where he was to be made king in Shechem. Now you'll remember that David became king over the northern tribes because he made a covenant with them. And perhaps this covenant had to be renewed each time there was a subsequent king. The assembly and I went to Rehoboam and said, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us. Now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke, and we will serve you." Rehoboam, however, refused to listen to the wise counsel of the elders who told him to go along with us. Instead, he listened to his young friends. And he told us, "My father made your yoke heavy. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions." When we saw the king was not going to listen to us, we went back to Israel and left Judah to look after its own house. Then Rehoboam sent out Adoniram, who was over his labor force, but Israel stoned him to death, and Rehoboam had to flee back to Jerusalem. Rehoboam then led Judah and Benjamin to make war against us. But just as civil war was about to break out, God told him to go back home, not to fight, because the secession and my ascension had been God's doing. So, with all this, why didn't I just trust in God's promises? I got so caught up. Instead of worrying about the people and leading them, I was worrying about protecting my throne. First, I fortified Shechem and made my home there. And then I began to fear that the kingdom would go back to David if the people, as they went to Jerusalem for their sacrifices at the temple, decided that they wanted to be part of that again and go back to Rehoboam and probably would kill me. So after seeking advice, I made two golden calves. This was a blatant violation of God's commandment, of course, against graven images. And I told the people, it was too far to go to Jerusalem. You don't need to do that. I told them that these were the gods that had brought them out of Egypt. And I placed one of the golden calves in the northern city of Dan, which was very convenient for the northern populace. And I put the other one down at Bethel, right on the border, so that every time they went to Jerusalem, they had to pass right by it. Okay, and what other evil things did I do? Well, I put shrines in high places, just like the Canaanites had done. I appointed priests that weren't Levites and installed priests in Bethel in the high places. I instituted a festival in Bethel, like Judah's festival of the tabernacles, but offering sacrifices to the golden calves. And I've been much criticized that the golden calf cult and its sexual immorality became a continuing snare to the people of Israel. Now one day, when I was standing by the altar at Bethel, a man of God came up from Judah, and he looked at the altar, and he said to the altar, "A son named Josiah will be born to the house of David. On you he will sacrifice the priests of the high places who now make offerings here, and human bones will be burned on you." And this came true in Josiah's time. The man also said the Lord had declared the altar would be split and the ashes would be spread out. And then I stretched out my hand and I yelled, "Seize that man!" And as I did, my arm shriveled up. And the altar split and the ashes went everywhere. So I turned to the man of God and implored him to intercede with God to heal my arm. And God, in his mercy, did heal my arm. But even after this, I continued to appoint priests to the high places. Anyone who wanted to become a priest could become one. And soon after this altar incident, my son Abijah became ill. I told my wife to disguise herself and go to Ahijah in Shiloh. Remember, he was the one that tore the cloak. And to find out what was going to happen to my son. And because of my guilt, I was afraid if Ahijah recognized her, that he wouldn't give a favorable prophecy. But even though Ahijah had lost his sight, God had told him that my wife was coming in disguise, and he told Ahijah what to say to me. But the news was not good. God's message was that even though he'd made a leader and torn Israel away from David for me, I had not kept his commandments and had done more evil than all who lived before me. Because of this, he would bring disaster to my house until it was gone. The boy Abijah would die, and he would be the only one of my house that would be honored in burial, because he was the only one in whom God saw any good. Furthermore, God would raise up a king that would cut off my house completely. And that happened in just the next generation with Baasha. He would also uproot Israel and scatter them beyond the river because they provoked him to anger by making Asherah poles. And he did allow the Assyrians to spread us out, scatter us across the river. He would give Israel up because of my sins, the sins I committed and caused Israel to commit. And then finally, in the 18th year of my reign, Abijah, Rehoboam's son, became king of Judah. This was after Rehoboam's death. And there was a war between us. Abijah had about 400,000 men, but I had 800,000. But Abijah stood on Mount Zemaran in Ephraim and called to me in Israel, "Don't you know the Lord has given the kingship of Israel to David and his descendants forever? Yet you rebelled against Solomon and opposed his son Rehoboam when he was young and indecisive." He reminded us that though we were a vast army, we had turned to pagan practices, whereas they had obeyed the ways of the Lord. Abijah said, "God is with us. He is our leader." And although we had maneuvered an ambush that completely surrounded them, God gave the victory to them, and we lost 500,000 men. Abijah pursued me and took many of my towns and villages, including Bethel. I never regained my former power. And then the Lord struck me down in death. I had reigned 22 years. My son Nadab succeeded me. Throughout the ages, my name has stood condemned as one who disregarded the Lord and caused Israel to sin.
Tough act.
I know.
Okay. That's Jeroboam. Well done. Jeroboam's son Nadab was next king that we have no one doing a report on. Baasha we'll hear about next week when we study about the northern kings. And then Elah, who was Baasha's son. And then after that we had a guy named Zimri, who lasted a full 7 days as the king. And then after Zimri, we had Omri. And Omri is Debbie's. So Debbie, if you would give us a report on Omri. He was the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 king.
Okay, you don't get handouts if you want them afterwards. I'll go around photocopies. I debated I may switch in and out of person because, you know, only part of me can identify with Omri.
This is a small part.
I hope. Most of the time it's a small part. Omri, I am Omri. I was sixth king of Israel after the division. I came to power during the most turbulent time in all of Israel's history. My reign began with more dissension and confusion than any other king. I spent my early years rising through the military ranks in the kingdom, in the armies of Israel. I was so good at what I did that I became commander of the army under King Baasha, or however you pronounce his name. While he was ruling from his cushy palace in Tirzah, I and the army were camped outside of Gibbethon in Philistia. During these dark days, that little louse Zimri murdered our king, our beloved King Baasha. When the news reached us, the men in my army immediately declared me the new king of Israel. However, Zimri, of course, had declared himself king, so we marched to Tirzah and laid siege to the capital. After 7 days, Zimri committed suicide, and I was now the king of Israel. However, unfortunately, some upstart named Tibni had a group of followers who decided that he should be king of Israel. Little did they know. This was the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah. He stayed out of my way, and Tibni and I, we duked it out for 4 years before I finally was victorious. My army followed me faithfully. I had been their commander, and now I was their king. For 6 years, I reigned the nation of Israel from the city of Tirzah. At the end of this time, I concluded a business dealing with a man named Shemer, and for 150 pounds of silver, I purchased a hill, and I started a building program. And my servants began building the great city of Samaria. Samaria became such a wonderful, glowing city that centuries later, the whole region was still known by the same name. Another part of my wonderful legacy, I stormed those little piddly people in Moab and conquered them. They were so incensed about this that I was the first king of Israel to have my legacy recorded in some form outside the Bible. Mesha, later a king of Moab, after my time, he erected a monument that recorded his defeat of one of my sons. But I began a dynasty that lasted for 40 years. For 40 years from the beginning of my reign, those of my blood ruled the nation of Israel. I brought stability to a kingdom that had been in utter disarray. Imagine that little Zimri, 7 days as king. But what upheaval for the poor people of Israel, and I brought stability to them. Now, I know that you've heard these terrible reports of my life, but truly my name meant, the Lord is my life. Too bad it didn't actually play out that way. It is true, I brought great stability to the nation of Israel, built a wonderful glowing city, but what is this legacy? For the book that you refer to records the truth of my life. I did not serve the Lord all my days. In fact, I was known as the most evil king of all time until my death, when I turned over the kingdom to my son Ahab. And the seed did not fall far from the tree. After 11 years of my wicked rule, and all that I did for the nation of Israel, Ahab took that legacy, and he left a legacy that leaves you knowing his name and not mine.
And now a king that needs no introduction, or at least doesn't deserve one. Marcia, we're gonna do Ahab.
Do you have Ahab?
I have Ahab.
Well, okay.
So are you going to sing to us about Ahab?
No, I'm not going to do any rap on King Ahab. I think you all understand Ahab was not a very nice guy. There isn't a whole lot of good that's ever found on him, or at least that I have found. And I'm going to tell you about Ahab. I'm not Ahab, but I will tell you about him. King Ahab's stories can be found in 1 Kings and in 2 Chronicles. He was the son of Omri, as we just heard. His reign lasted for 22 years, and he was considered a great and powerful king because he had 70 sons. That's how they decided how great and powerful they were, by how many sons they had. Well, then he married his wife, Jezebel. She was just a fine woman, as we all know. She was into the Baal and the Asherah worshiper, and she convinced him to leave his god and to worship her gods. Ahab's evil was contested by the prophet Elijah, that lasted through all of Ahab's career, and their biography, they're just kind of intermingled together because we had a little kind of a good angel and a bad angel. And through Elijah, God repeatedly displayed his power, graciously giving Ahab many opportunities to change his ways, which he did not. Ahab's evil practices spread throughout the land. Knowing that people were likelier to repent in bad times than good times, Elijah, this is the good and the bad again, had been praying for a famine. So he, in order to warn Ahab and give him the opportunity for repentance, God sent Elijah to announce the famine that he'd been praying for, that there would be no rain or no dew in Israel until Elijah said so. This lasted for 3.5 years. Elijah told Ahab this was going to happen, and he took off because Ahab was not happy with that at all. So it did. It lasted 3.5 years. At God's prompting, Elijah came out of exile and confronted Ahab, who was busy trying to cope with the famine because, you know, that wasn't a good thing at that point. One of my little things says, and at that point, Ahab probably would like to have lopped off Elijah's head, blaming him for the famine. But he feared that if he didn't do something, it was never going to end, because God had said it will end with Elijah's approval, or saying that it's going to end. So this is where the thing where we saw the movie where they talked about they had gone to the mount and Elijah said, we're going to do a test. I want to take your 450 prophets against me, and we're going to see. So they built their altars, and the 450, they tried and tried, and God didn't do anything. And Elijah built his altar and light the fire. I need to turn the page. And Ahab said he would do this, so they started early in the morning. They stacked wood, and they did their sacrifices and called out to Baal to light the fire. Nothing happened. And it went from all morning until the evening when Elijah said, ha ha, ain't gonna work, my turn. So he rebuilt the simple altar to the Lord, which they had been deteriorated from years of neglect. He slaughtered his animal and prepared the sacrifice to give God even more glory and to make it even more impressive. He drenched the wood, and which was very dry because of the famine, and he built a little circle around it where the water went in. And Elijah had a simple prayer asking for the Lord to demonstrate that he was the true God, and that the purpose of the famine was to turn the hearts back to the Lord. In that moment, something like a bolt of lightning struck Elijah's altar with such violence that the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the water were all destroyed. Well, he won. So they went ahead and had all of these 450 Baal prophets executed. So Elijah also told Ahab, you better get undercover because it's fixing to rain. So move it. So finally, they had a huge rainstorm ending the years of famine. Well, Jezebel was not happy about this, that all these guys were killed, so she ordered Elijah to get killed. So off he runs again because she's going to get him. Well, Ahab and Ben-Hadad? Is that okay? He was the king of the neighboring Syria. We're going to attack him. And he demanded payment. He, you know, was going to attack Ahab, and he said, I want silver and gold, plus I want the best of your wives and the children. And Ahab said, well, oh, okay. And then Ben-Hadad said, no, I want some more. Give me more. And Ahab said, no, I'm not giving you any more. So he went to God, and a prophet came to him and said that you could defeat Ben-Hadad if you led the attack yourself. So he did. He followed God's word. He led the attack, took care of it. He came upon the army, and they were all drunk, and he attacked them. So it's not like it was real difficult, but, you know, it still worked. And upon the victory, the prophet told him to strengthen his stance, because strengthen your position, because Ben-Hadad would strike again in the spring. So sure enough, spring came, and it found that they were on their way. That Ben-Hadad was encouraging the troops by saying they lost the last battle because they were in the hill country, which is where Ahab's God was. But if they fought in the valleys, that it was going to be okay, and that's where Ahab's God was powerless. So the Lord was determined to show him. So they fought and they fought, and Syrian's army was routed, and Ben-Hadad was left to escape. He was unable to escape. He surrendered, but then Ahab let him go, and he didn't ask the Lord what he should do. So he let him go. He released Ben-Hadad, which is going to come back and bite him later. Then, about 20 miles north of his capital, Ahab had a palace in Jezreel. Mm-hmm. Wanting to improve his property, he tried to buy this other parcel of land that was next to his from his neighbor, Naboth. We're okay with that, Naboth? Although Ahab made him a generous offer, and Naboth said, no, this has been in my family for generations. I'm not going to sell it. It's mine. Sorry. Well, that made Ahab really upset, and he was depressed, and he was mad. And so Jezebel said, what's wrong, baby? He's, well, I want to buy that property, and they won't sell it to me. She said, don't worry. I'll take care of it. So she ordered the local leaders to frame this guy on capital charges, and execute him by stoning him. And, of course, with their customs, they had to execute Naboth's sons as well. So with everybody dead, Ahab just kind of took it. So as he was working in his vineyard, Elijah came to him and said, since you murdered this guy and took his field, this same field's where you're going to die in disgrace. Not only that, but your entire family is going to be exterminated, gone, and your wife's going to be eaten by dogs. Well, Ahab did have a conscience, a little bit, but he did have it. And he said, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to do this. This is terrible. Please don't let this happen to my family. And so God said that he would delay the prophesying until the next generations. But his sons were just as evil, and they didn't repent. Okay, then he had a prophet, Micaiah. I'm having the same trouble you are. Okay, so Ahab went over to King Jehoshaphat, and they had some treaties. They had suffered losses to the Syrians, to this King Ben-Hadad again. See, it's coming back again. If they killed him, they wouldn't have had to worry about it. And so they wanted to have this land. So Jehoshaphat and Ahab got together. They formed a treaty. They asked the Lord's approval first. That was Jehoshaphat's idea. Ahab called all of his, he had another 400 false prophets that came. And they said, oh, you're going to do fine. Victory is yours. Go for it. Well, Jehoshaphat said, I'm not really sure about these guys. Let's find another prophet. So they found Micaiah. They found Micaiah. And Micaiah was really afraid to tell them what was going to happen, because it wasn't going to be really good. He was going to have to tell them that Ahab was going to end up not winning and getting killed. Well, Micaiah also said that these 400 prophets are going to tell you that you're going to win and you're really not. So Ahab didn't like that, because it showed that he was wrong. So he had Micaiah jailed, and Micaiah said to him, if you return alive, then I am a false prophet. So off they went.
But he didn't want to get killed. Ahab didn't want to get killed, so he sent Jehoshaphat in his place. And so these other guys, thinking that they were going to be attacking Ahab, started to attack Jehoshaphat. Well, Jehoshaphat, at that point, shouted to the Lord for rescue. Well, Ben-Hadad's men realized that Ahab would not be shouting for the Lord. He'd be calling on somebody else. So they went, uh-oh, this isn't him. We got to go look for him. So Jehoshaphat did not get killed. So they went and looked for Ahab. Well, Ahab ended up being struck by a random arrow that killed him. Didn't kill him, but it mortally wounded him. Had his charioteer take him home. He died outside the palace in Naboth's field, and the dogs licked up his blood, like they said it was going to happen. Okay, years later, an army captain named Ahu, acting on the Lord's instructions, had all of Ahab's descendants killed, and they cut off their head. Yeah, here you go. Get ready to come. Yeah. Had all the guys had their heads chopped off. Well, Jezebel was still alive. She was thrown from a window and landed down below. The fall or the landing killed her. And so when the men that went out to bury her got out there, she had been eaten by dogs, which is what the prophet had said before. This fulfilled Elijah's prophet. To back a lot of this up, archaeologists from Harvard, digging in the ruins of Samaria, found a palace which they believe that Ahab built, which contained a room where ivories were stored. And this goes back, and it talks about that the houses, it was in Amos, that the houses of ivory shall perish. That's what they were talking about. They also found in this ivory room a small stone box, which they believe Jezebel had used to mix her cosmetics. The box contained a number of small holes to hold various colors and a depression in the middle for mixing, which in 2 Kings it talks about Jezebel heard of it and she put paint on her eyes and adorned her head and looked through a window. Then the last one that I found was the Oriental Institute of Chicago during excavations near Samaria found the ruins of a temple that was built during King Ahab's time, and they found jars containing the remains of infants who had been sacrificed, which further talks about the Baal worshiping that they had. They also found a seal, which they think belonged to her, and it was inscribed with JZBL, which is what her seal had said, and she sealed documents, and that was one of the seals that they thought that she had used. So that was it.
Thank you, Marcia.
Ahab might not have deserved an intro, but you did. I'm just going to say it that way. The couple of notes here. One is, just as everybody has given the reports, if your report's not this long, don't get worried or anything, because some of the kings don't have that much written about them. The ones that we've had so far have a lot of information. So stay encouraged, okay? We're going to skip past the next one that would be there. Let's see. The next one will be Yehu, and that's Karen. Specifically, we are going past Ahaziah, Jehoram, and then this one is Yehu.
Okay, I'm reporting on King Yehu, and it's not going to be in first person either. He was the 10th king of northern Israel. He reigned 28 years. His father was Jehoshaphat, but not King Jehoshaphat, and they only had this one reference that his father was Jehoshaphat. His son, Jehoahaz became king upon his death. Jehu means Yahweh is he. He was actually known as a fiend in human form. Another thing I had was that he was one of the most decisive, terrible, ambitious, yet prudent, calculating, and passionless men whom God from time to time raises up to change the fate of empires and execute his judgments on the earth. He was known for his swift chariot driving, and he was the first king to face the Assyrians.
Some of his strengths and accomplishments were he was the man who eradicated the house of Ahab from Israel. He founded the longest lived dynasty in Northern Kingdom. He was the only king who was actually anointed by Elijah and then confirmed by Elisha, and he destroyed Baal worship. Unfortunately, he was not a good king, and his reckless outlook on life made him bold and prone to errors. He worshiped Jeroboam's golden calves, and he was devoted to God only to the point that obedience served his own interest. Now, Jehu was one of the commanders in King Jeroboam's army. And when King Jeroboam was injured, he went to Jezreel to recover. And Jehu was at Ramoth Gilead, and he was meeting with his officers when he was approached by a prophet of Elisha. The prophet asked to speak to him privately, and he informs him that he's been anointed the new king of Israel, the people of the Lord. And that's kind of a strange way of putting it, because Israel and Judea were separate kingdoms and were not obedient to the covenant, but the people were still the chosen one of the Lord and Abraham's descendants. The prophet tells him that Jehu has been commissioned to destroy the house of Ahab, and his main task was to wipe out the family of Ahab and execute God's judgment upon them because of all the innocent people they had killed. The prophet especially mentions Jezebel's crimes and her judgment, referring to the words that Elijah spoke when he confronted Ahab. So, after he's anointed, Jehu goes out, and to his credit, he didn't right away announce that he was king, but his officers noticed that he had the oil, so they questioned him, and he finally admits it, so they started shouting, "Jehu is king," and shouting trumpets. He selects a small band of officers or soldiers, and they go out to meet King Jeroboam to carry out his judgment. But on the way out there, King Jeroboam recognizes Jehu by his chariot driving and sends out a messenger. The messenger is immediately taken captive by King Jehu, and he keeps continuing on. When he doesn't hear back from him, he sends out a second messenger, who is immediately captured. At this point, King Jeroboam and Hezekiah both decide to ride out because they think maybe the war has ended and that he's coming with a message of peace. When King Jeroboam approaches him, he asks him, "Is there peace?" And his response is, "What peace? So long as the whoredoms of thy mother Jezebel and her witchcrafts are so many." He realizes that he didn't come in peace, that he's actually there in a revolt. And as he turns to escape, Jehu shoots him with an arrow through the heart and kills him immediately. King Ahaziah tries to escape, and he does actually get away, but his men chase him down and they kill him later. By this time, Jezebel is in Jezreel, and she realizes that both her son is dead. So she puts on her makeup, and she tries to seduce him when he enters the palace. She tries to suggest that his newly found power is weak, and they should form an alliance and strengthen his throne. And she even mentions King Zimri, that he only was there for 8 days after he had actually overthrown the previous king. He orders her thrown from the palace, and the eunuchs are out, and the book I read said she broke like a watermelon. At which point he goes down and rides his horse over him, and that actually was actually worse than death itself, was a desecration of a body. So then he goes back in the palace and decides he needs to eat. And as he's eating, he realizes that, well, she was a princess and deserves to be buried as such, but it was too late, as the wild dogs had devoured her, leaving only her skull, feet, and palms, fulfilling Elijah's prophet. None of these actions had displeased the Lord. But then Jehu goes on a search and destroy mission of all of Ahab's descendants. He approached the leaders of Samaria, where the 70 sons of Ahab lived, but they were protected because they were being prepared for places of worship or leadership in the government. But he starts using intimidation tactics. His first challenge was that they appoint a king, and then they would fight, and winner would take all over who would be king. But the leaders decided they don't want to do that, and they send a message of complete unconditional surrender. They promise to do whatever Jehu commands, and then they send him the 70 heads of his sons, and he stacks them up by the entrance of the city. Jehu, to prove he was loyal to God and Persian land of all of Ahab's Arab's family, he kills all of Ahab's descendants, But he doesn't stop there. He goes on and kills all of his close friends, his chief officers, and the priests who served him in the palace. Which kind of backfired, because when they faced the Syrians later, he kind of probably could have used some of their knowledge. But Jehu's divine commission became a personal crusade motivated by his own selfish ambition. Another example was when he was on his way to Samaria, he meets a group of travelers. And the book I read, it was described as they were relatives of a king,
Ahaziah.
It doesn't say anything. I read somewhere else that they were his nephews. None of them were aware of all the three deaths. But he kills all 42 of them because they were related to Ahaziah, when actually they were descendants of David. So he just kind of went crazy. His other accomplishment was destroying the Baal worship. He destroyed both Ahab's house or family and the house that Ahab had built for Baal. He assembled all the priests, the ministers, and the prophets of Baal, and announced that he wanted to have a great sacrifice. So they went through all the kingdom announcing it, and he wanted all the Baal worshipers to wear special garments, so that way he would only get the true Baal. People who worship would only be the ones who were killed. He had stationed 80 soldiers outside the temple while they were doing the sacrifice, but actually Jehu was the one who provided the sacrifice, so he himself was actually making a sacrifice to Baal. After the sacrifice was over, the soldiers went in and killed all the worshipers and threw their bodies out in the court. They removed the wooden image and the stone image of Baal, and then he had the pillars taken down and burned, and the walls taken down, and he turned it to a public toilet. He enlisted the help of Jimhadab. He was more respected. He thought that by doing this, that it would give him more credibility. Jehu's first act as king was one of deception. While he did have the authority to kill the idolaters, why did he have to deceive them? He also followed in the ways of Jeroboam and worshipped the golden calves. The calves were supposed to be the symbols of Jehovah, but it was idolatry the same. He also, in order to receive protections against the Syrians, he paid tribute to Shalmaneser. And actually, that's still depicted on a black obelisk that's in the British Museum, and it's the only likeness of any of the kings anywhere. Jehu, he slew the prophets of Baal, but he did not turn to the prophets of God. Since Jehu did not turn to the Lord, he's only given an earthly reward. The reign of his house would be for four generations only. In spite of his zeal for the Lord, Jehu was an idolater at heart who only used the Lord's name to cover up his own sins. Jehu was judged not because he followed God's commandments, but because all that he did was for his own benefit, not God's glory. He was an effective soldier, but not of a builder, and he's remembered only for the people that he killed.
Thank you very much. You ever notice how that with all the biblical names people have named their children, there's not hardly that many Ahabs or Jezebels? You know? And this guy, he was a real Jehu. You know, you don't hear. Okay. We're going to skip on down to Sandy is next with Hosea. Hosea. And this will conclude the northern kings. We saved the south so that you can hear some kings that are good.
So far, they haven't had a real good track record.
Okay, this is real short because I had a whole six verses to work from. And that was it. Okay. Hosea was the 19th and last king of Israel. His reign lasted 9 years and began during the 12th year of the reign of Ahaz, king of Judah. Hosea conspired against and obtained his reign by assassinating Pekah, which is one of the earlier kings, son of Remaliah. He seized his opportunity after Pekah had suffered a number of military failures, losing portions of Israel to the Assyrians during the first conquest. Even though Hosea did evil in the eyes of the Lord, he was not as bad as some of his predecessors, obviously. According to some, he appears to have not started, continued, or compelled his people to participate in any of the practices of Baal worship or the symbolic worship of the calves. Others say he took off the embargo which the former kings had put to their subjects under, forbidding them to go to Jerusalem to worship. Sadly, though, his bloody overthrow of Pekah and his violent ascent to power did not make him unusually evil amongst the other kings of Israel. For many years, Hoshea continued to pay tribute or money to the Assyrian kings in the same manner, and in the reference I had said Manahem had initiated before him, but it looks like it was even before that. And these were, I found a couple of places where the Assyrian documents actually confirm what's in the Bible. And in one place it says, the writings of Tiglath-Pileser III, king of Assyria, confirm what is written in the Bible, that Hoshea paid him an annual tribute of 10 talents of gold and 1,000 talents of silver. A few years after Hoshea becomes king, Tiglath-Pileser III dies, and Shalmaneser the fourth becomes the next king of Assyria. She originally decides to keep sending the money to Shalmaneser as he did before. For a time he did, anyway. He remained Shalmaneser's vassal, and I like the way he explained this, which meant the Israelites were under Shalmaneser's protection and vowed their Assyrians homage and intense fidelity. At this time, Egypt and Assyria were in constant power struggle. Hoshea decides it's time to break off his submission to Assyria and looks to Egypt for protection. Hoshea sent messengers to him and made negotiations with So, the king of Egypt. He ceased paying tributes to Shalmaneser. When Shalmaneser discovered that Hoshea had done what he had done, he seized Hoshea and put him in prison. Shalmaneser proceeded to lay siege to the Israel for 3 years. Upon his conquest, Shalmaneser deported the Israelites to Assyria. He settles them in Hala, in the Gozan on the Habor River, and in the towns of Medes. The captivity of the Israel is also recorded in the Assyrian records. During the siege of Samaria, Shalmaneser dies and is succeeded by Sargon. An inscription found in archaeological writings of Sargon states, "In the first year of my reign, I captured Samaria along with 27,290 captives. The foreigners of a land who never paid me tribute, I settled in Samaria." We can assume that the Assyrians followed their typical custom as they depopulated and exiled a conquered community. To lead the captives away on journeys hundreds of miles away, naked and attached together with a system of strings and fish hooks pierced through their lower lip. God would make sure that they were led in this humiliating manner, though, through the broken walls of their conquered cities, as indicated in Amos 4:2-3. After 200 years and 19 kings after the time of Solomon, the northern kingdom of Israel fell. It was not because God was unable to help them, but because they had forsaken God and kept ignoring his guidance and correction. God finally stopped actively protecting them and let them fall into their corruptness. Hoshea's great mistake was to rely on Egypt for help instead of the Lord. Isaiah 31:1 says, "Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help, and rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong, but who do not look to the Holy One of Israel, nor seek the Lord." The Israelites' ultimate failure was of their own making, by trusting themselves, other gods, and other nations, and not the Lord their God. They should have had no fear but fear in the Lord. And 2 Kings 17:35-41 says, "When the Lord made a covenant with the Israelites, he commanded them, 'Do not worship any other gods or bow down to them, serve them, or sacrifice to them. But the Lord who brought you up out of Egypt with a mighty power and outstretched arm is the one you must worship. To him you shall bow down and to him offer sacrifices. You must always be careful to keep the decrees and ordinances, the laws and commands he wrote for you. Do not worship other gods. Do not forget the covenant I have made with you, and do not worship other gods. Rather, worship the Lord your God. It is he who will deliver you from the hand of all your enemies.' They would not listen, however, but persisted in their former practices. Even while these people were worshiping the Lord, they served other idols." Thus they were captured.
Well, let's see. It's bad, 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 bad. Extra bad, the worst. Bad, mostly bad. Okay, so we're finally through with that. And now we get to hear about the South. We will maybe take a break, or if you want to get up and take a break on your own, whatever you want to do. But we'll try to get through one or two more so that we'll have a good breaking spot. But now we're going to go back in time. We went from the very end of the Northern Kingdom's reign to the beginning of the South, and we'll see a report from Jean about Rehoboam and the first king of the South.
Mine is a summary.
Okay. You can find Rehoboam in 1 Kings 12, 1 to 24, in chapter 14, 21 to 31, and in 2 Chronicles 10, chapters 10 to 12. Rehoboam was the son of Solomon and the grandson of David, so he had quite an inheritance and quite an act to follow. His mother was Naamah, and she was an Ammonite. And Rehoboam altogether had 18 wives, 60 concubines, and from them had 28 sons and 60 daughters. He had a favorite wife, and her name was Maacah, and they had a son together named Abijah, and Rehoboam had appointed him to be the chief prince of all the brothers so that one day he may also be king. Following Solomon's death, Rehoboam succeeded him as king. He was 41 years old when he became king, and he was the first ruler of the southern kingdom of Judah. He was made king in Shechem, and as the news traveled about Solomon's death and that Rehoboam was now going to be king, the local leaders wanted to seek Jeroboam and seek some guidance from him, and so they kind of wanted to have a collective bargaining session with the king, the new king. And they thought of Jeroboam as being a well-respected person due to his leadership skills. So at this time, and June said a whole lot of this stuff, there was a lot of heavy taxation and heavy burdens and lots of heavy yoke placed upon them, and it was a carryover of Solomon's reign. And so with Jeroboam's, you know, guidance, they had gotten together and they decided that they would agree that they might serve Rehoboam if he would lower that heavy burden, you know, make it lighter and take away some of the taxes and replace that he had placed on them. So he said, well, let me consider this, and I'm going to go away for 3 days, and when I come back, I'll let you know my decision. So he consulted with the elders, and these would have been the people that also provided Solomon guidance. And they said, pretty much, be kind to everyone, and they will serve you forever. And he chose to, maybe I'll listen to that, but I'm going to go seek the advice of the younger council. And they pretty much told him, make the yoke heavier, make everything harsher, and this is what you need to do. So Rehoboam forsook the council of the elders, and he went with the side of the younger people instead and made a very foolish decision in doing that. So when he returned after 3 days, he shared his decision with them. And as a result, the 12 tribes of Israel seceded, and then that left two, Benjamin and Judah, to remain with Rehoboam. So the United Kingdom divided. And Rehoboam couldn't believe that the people were actually rebelling against him, and he ignored their decision to secede. And he even accompanied his tax collector in the usual duties. And while that happened, the Israelites stoned him to death, and Rehoboam was able to escape in his chariot. Still in denial, he decided, I'm going to gather an army, and I'm going to try to win back these revolted 10 tribes. And Jeroboam, who was king of the 10 tribes, also prepared an army. So as the civil war was about to begin, God sent a prophet, and the prophet Shemaiah gave the message to Rehoboam that he should go home and not fight any longer. And he was told that splitting this nation was part of God's plan. So Rehoboam was faithful to the Lord for about 3 years. But then with the aid of his wife, who was an Asher worshiper, he began building pagan shrines, and cults formed, and lots of sexual immorality, and lots of male prostitution took place. And then after 2 years of apostasy, Shishak? I don't know.
Shishak.
Shishak. The king of Egypt launched an invasion against Judah, and the Lord sent the prophet Shemaiah again to announce that because of their apostasy, he would no longer defend Judah. So Rehoboam actually admitted that they deserved this punishment. He humbled himself, and as a result, God changed his mind. He said, I'm not going to destroy Judah, but I'm going to place Judah, I'm going to let Egypt dominate Judah. And so Egypt subdued Judah, and Shishak confiscated everything that of value that Rehoboam had. Rehoboam's repentance was very short-lived. During his reign, there were constant battles between Rehoboam and Jeroboam, and much of his reign can be summarized in the statement from 2 Chronicles 12:14. He did evil because he prepared not his heart to seek the Lord. And Rehoboam died at 58 and was buried in Jerusalem. Just a couple of side notes from a commentary. In Ecclesiastes 2:19, Solomon states that he's not sure if the next king would be wise or be a fool, and he was actually speaking of Rehoboam, and actually he was a fool. Rehoboam was probably exposed in his upbringing to lots of pagan worship since his mother practiced this. And he was probably a very spoiled person who always got his way, was never held accountable for anything, blamed others for all of his problems, and no spiritual training in his home. So the point being that if God needed a man to divide a kingdom, Solomon had prepared one, his son Rehoboam. And maybe a life application for today, as Christians, we need to look at the advice from those who are spiritually sound as nothing less than a gift from God. And we shouldn't allow pride to cloud the wise counsel which we are fortunate to receive. So.
Okay. As we proceed through the South, we're going to skip a couple of kings and get to this next one. And you will note the difference between the North and the South also is that all of these kings are in the line of David. There's one where you have to stretch it a little bit, and we'll have a report on that later on. But they all are in the line of David. Whereas the other kings, it sounded like the Godfather movie. You know, didn't you get that feeling? You know, they whacked them and then they get to be king. And then in the last one we did the report on, we were even talking about how that they had paid the vassal, which was defined as giving protection. You know, how the mob would protect the restaurants by taking the money and then they'd tear it up. It was that kind of protection, too, that they got. So a whole lot different story in the South.
Were there no good kings?
In the North?
I got a good king.
You got a good king?
I got a good king.
Good.
Not from the...
We're going to hear about the first good king from Ed, who is going to tell us about Jehoshaphat.
Wait, this guy's good?
Oh, no. Yeah, he's the best one so far.
It's all relative, Ed. It's all relative.
So I don't know, you know, I read through everything in the Bible about I guess it would be Jehoshaphat, but we'll say Jehoshaphat since that's what we're all used to saying, I guess. But everybody's heard of jumping Jehoshaphat, I assume.
Yep. Yeah.
I could not find any reason to call him that other than it sounded cool, so... I mean, like, I did operettas in grade school about jumping Jehoshaphat. I don't know why. But anyway.
So it's really jumping Jehoshaphat.
Jumping Jehoshaphat, yeah. I'll stick to my notes, sorry.
Maybe it's a northern thing.
Maybe.
why did he have that nickname?
I don't know.
Well, you don't know.
I don't know. No idea. Couldn't find a reference. But it sounds cool. Jumping Jehoshaphat.
Yeah. I remember hearing it. Yeah.
Anyway, like Roger said, everybody... started with David, so in this case we've got David, then Solomon, Rehoboam, Rehoboam's son Abijah, Abijah's son Asa, and then our buddy Jehoshaphat, whose name means the Lord judges. He actually ruled with his father for 3 years, so Asa kind of prepared him to be king. They were co-regents for 3 years, starting in 872 BC. Took over complete independent reign of Judah in 869. Reigned through 848, and then followed in his father's steps in that his son Ahab, Jehoram, his son, reigned with him as co-regent as well. His reign of Judah, Jehoshaphat's reign of Judah, started in the fourth year of Ahab's reign. He was 35 years old. He reigned for a total of 25 years, 22 years of which he was sole king, succeeded by his son Jehoram in 848, and he's buried in Jerusalem. Well, he was buried. He may still be there, I'm not sure. But he only had seven sons, so I guess in the scheme of the day, he wasn't that great and powerful of a king. But in general, though, especially in Chronicles, he is portrayed as a good king, if not one of the best kings of the southern kingdom of Judah. He's said to have walked with the Lord like his father, doing right in the eyes of the Lord, and there was a time of peace with Israel. I got a quote here, and I apologize, I don't remember where I got it from. It was on the internet, though. On one of the Jewish history sites, it says, "The story of King Jehoshaphat's 25-year reign simply glows with his devotion to the Lord. He never once fell into the pagan religion or practices that plagued neighboring Israel, and many of Judah's kings as well. Much of his story is a record of his religious reforms." So he was pretty close to David, as you could get, I guess. One of the things that he did is he strengthened the kingdom of Judah. He stationed troops and fortified cities and put some troops in Ephraim. Walked, in, especially in his early years, he walked really closely with the Lord. And he was honored. In doing that, he was honored by all the people of Judah. They brought him gifts. He became very wealthy. I forget the saying that you and Kurt have been using, but so goes the king, so goes the people, or something like that. But so the king, Jehoshaphat, walks with the Lord, and so did the people. He sent leaders and Levites and priests throughout Judah to teach the law. So kind of rechristened the priesthood, if you will. And then even the lands around Judah feared the Lord. They saw that Judah was prospering so much under the Lord that they feared Judah because of that, and even brought tribute to Judah. And I thought it was really neat that, interesting that even the Philistines did. Of course, they have a love-hate relationship with God, but they were obvious that God was with Judah and Jehoshaphat's day, and they brought tribute. Of course, not everything went well for Jehoshaphat. Late in his reign, he wanted to build a fleet of trading ships, which would have been fine, except he did it in league with King Ahaziah from Israel for doing some trade in gold, and there was a prophecy that was fulfilled that they were wrecked before they even got to set sail as a judgment from God. I forget who did, but Ahab, told us about our problems with Jehoshaphat and Ahab. He actually married the daughter of Ahab, Athaliah, and I've got the story here about going down to fight in Ramoth-Gilead, and Ahab says, "Hey," Jehoshaphat says, "Hey, let's ask God first." And Ahab says, "Sure, I got 400 priests. Let's have them ask God." And all 400 of them say, "Yeah, no problem." And like you said, Jehoshaphat's like, "Well, let's ask one more person." And so we got Micaiah, and Ahab, of course, doesn't like Micaiah. He always says bad things. Then Jehoshaphat insists, and Micaiah says, we heard earlier what Micaiah says. But they decide to go anyway. And Ahab, of course, says, "Jehoshaphat, well, you go, you wear your robes, and I'll go in disguise." And then they attack Jehoshaphat, and then he cries out to God, and they realize it's not Ahab. And then Ahab gets the random arrow, and we heard about how his days end. When Jehoshaphat comes back from that, Yehu, not King Yehu, but a different Yehu, the seer, so a prophet named Yehu, warns him that, hey, welcome back from your victory, but God's not very happy. You know, you could have easily done this without being an ally with Ahab. And so it's kind of a mixed words from God. You know, he gets commended for his heart always seeking God, but then also gets criticized for allying with Israel instead of just relying on God. Something else that Jehoshaphat did, it's in 2 Chronicles 19, is he set up a system of courts throughout Judah. And so we get some judges. There's actually a judicial system set up, and he urges the judges to judge carefully, for with the Lord our God there's no injustice or partiality or bribery. So he sets up a judicial system based on the laws of God. Again, with the Levites and the priests and administrators of the law, also in Jerusalem. He decreed that the laws of the Lord would be the highest precedent for deciding cases, and the way that it's broken out, it's almost like a separation between church and state, at least the first version of it that I had ever seen, which is interesting. And then a little bit later, he didn't learn from his interaction with Ahab, and he joins Joram, who was, okay, let's see. So Moab was subject to Israel, the northern kingdom. They didn't like that. After the death of Ahab, they decided to revolt against Israel. And Joram, I believe Joram was next in line after Ahab. Is that right?
No,
Joram was two after Ahab.
Two after Ahab.
He was one of Ahab's sons.
There you go. Joram wanted to put Moab back in its place, but wanted to attack Moab from the rear, which would have meant having to go through Judah to do that. So of course he had to go, you know, ask Jehoshaphat to let his army go through Judah. And even though Jehoshaphat had already been condemned for going with Ahab, Jehoshaphat said, sure, I'll help you out. Why not? So not only can you come through my land, but we'll join up with you, and we'll even bring the king of Edom, which was really a governor. It's kind of a principality of Judah anyway. So Edom gets brought into it as well. And of course, since Israel's involved, they decided they didn't really need to ask God in advance. So they run out of water, and then it's only once they run out of water that they go and track down Elisha and ask Elisha what they should do. Solely because Jehoshaphat was with them, and God looked favorably on Jehoshaphat, God provided water from the mountains in Edom, which was I thought was unique because it's a desert. Edom is all pretty much desert, but God provided water from there, flowed down from the mountains, and then hands over the people of Moab to Israel and Judah. So let's see. So then later, Moab and Ammon attack Judah, I guess to kind of get back. But this time, Jehoshaphat actually learned and inquired of the Lord first and had the people fast. And then the prayer that's in 2 Chronicles mirrors the prayers of David, showing that he truly was a king after David's heart. And the Lord responds by promising to deliver Judah and Jerusalem, and Judah's army only needs to go and watch. So on their way, they're on their way to watch, and they're singing, "Give thanks to the Lord, for His love endures forever," and which like, we all know that verse throughout. It's used throughout the Bible. And God kills the army for them, and it took them 3 days to collect all the plunder. And they had Moab and the Moabites and Ammonites had all killed themselves. And, of course, all the other events of Jehoshaphat's reign are documented in the annals of Jehu, son of Hanani. And I actually tried to find the annals of Jehu, son of Hanani, and there are no known record of the book surviving through history. So.
It doesn't exist
anymore.
Not even on the internet.
Not even on the internet.
It's in a cave somewhere.
That's right. And he was succeeded by his firstborn son, Jehoram. And that's Jehoshaphat.
We're going to skip a couple of kings, and we're still in the same time frame, though. And we're going to go to Athaliah is the next one, and that would be Sandy. And there's ties between Athaliah and the Northern Kingdom.
Oh, there are so many ties.
As well as Jehoshaphat.
Athaliah, this was like doing Peyton Place or something. It was. There are so many relationships here. First off, she was a granddaughter of Omri, who was king of Israel. And she's the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. Now, there were some different references that said Jezebel maybe or maybe not was her mother, but the majority of them said that she was indeed the mother, which was interesting because she was never married to Ahab. Let's see, she was the wife of Jehoram, and being the wife of Jehoram, that was a marriage that was to seal a treaty between Israel and Judah. Because, let's see, yeah. And she was the mother of Ahaziah, and he was a king of Judah. Let's see, she worshipped the Baal, she hated God, and if you can look at who she was raised by, Ahab, she was in the presence of Ahab, in the presence of, I assume, Jezebel and all of these God haters. She didn't have a chance to ever know God. The way she became queen was when Ahaziah had, he was reigning as king, and he was king only 1 year. He had gone to visit Joram, who had been injured, and he went to meet Joram, and at that time they met up with Jehu, who, unbeknownst to these guys, Jehu had been anointed by God to destroy the house of Ahab. Well, Ahaziah and Joram both belonged to the house of Ahab, and these two princes were assassinated. Well, needless to say, Athaliah was pretty pissed off when she found this out. She found out that they got tricked, and they killed her son, and she had to decide then between choosing her grandchildren or choosing the throne. Power or kids? Easy choice for her. She took power. She just kind of went into a frenzy and had all of the grandchildren destroyed. And she nearly destroyed the entire line of David. However, God had provided that there would always be someone from the line of David on the throne. Well, she missed one of the grandchildren. Luckily, she missed one of the grandchildren, and that grandchild was, I must go to the next page, was Joash. Joash was rescued by his aunt. His aunt was, I need to get my cards right here. Sorry. His aunt was, Jehoshida, Shider, whatever. Anyhow, she was the wife of the priest, Jehoiada? Jehoiada?
That's close.
Is that it? Jehoiada. She was wife of that priest, Jehoiada, and they kept Joash in the temple and kept him hidden for 6 years. And so all this time she's reigning for the 6 years, and she was quite a tyrant. She had no supporters whatsoever, and so it was kind of cool because the priest decided when the child was 7 years old, Joash was 7 years old, they were going to have this coup and they were going to get rid of her. And so what they did was they kind of snuck around and they got all the priest and everything and all the guards to come and guard this little boy king. He was 7 years old. And they put the crown on his head and had him standing in these columns. And, you know, all these people were, and they declared him king. And they told all the people, and the people were cheering, "Long live the king, long live the king." And, well, she heard this and she was just like crazy mad. And she came tearing into the temple and said, "You know, what is going on here? Treason, treason, what's going on?" And she's tearing her clothes and all this business. And she realized then her mistake. Oh, she missed somebody. Whoops. And so she was taken outside of the temple by the guards, and the axe was put to her. They killed her. And, of course, all the people cheered and everything that she was gone. And let me see, what else was I missing? But she did, it was a really interesting time. Her accounts are in 2 Kings chapter 8, chapter 11, and in 2 Chronicles chapter 22 and 23 and 24. And it was just some really bizarre things went on in that period of time. Like the people were so evil, and I mean there was a report of women eating their children, and it was a quite a terrible famine during that time, and it was just kind of bizarre. And I thought it was really strange that her name means God is exalted, and she never once exalted God. And it said, though the Bible presents her as a negative character, not to be emulated, Athaliah is attested, though infrequently, as a female name, first name in contemporary Israel. And let's see, what else did I miss? I had more things, but what did I miss? The events of her reign and everything are the subject of, who's the author? I can't remember the name of the author. But the subject of, Racine's Athalie. It's I don't know, it's like I don't know how to describe it. It's a story or something that they wrote based on that. Let's see. And she was the only queen to occupy the throne of Judah, and which is quite an accomplishment if she hadn't been such a wench. And I guess
so
that's
she was
right.
Not a descendant of David.
She was not a descendant of David. No, so that's the one where you have to stretch it a little bit.
She was married into the line.
She was married into the family.
Right. Okay.
Good job, Sam. At this time, the family tree began to look like a tumbleweed.
But we get back online here to this next one. Just real quick, we got five more to go. Break or no break? Okay? Keep going. Again, if you need to, get up and go.
All right.
Well, we just heard about Athaliah, and then we heard about the coup with Joash, and we're going to hear about that now from Stephen. Joash is the next one.
Because he did other good things.
All right. So Joash made a little outline here while everyone else was talking. just because I felt like, you know, it is a big tumbleweed. You had Jehoram, son of Jehoshaphat, as I heard on the radio the other day. Then you had Ahab, and Jezebel had Athaliah. Athaliah had Ahaziah. Ahaziah died off, and so Athaliah killed off all our grandkids, made her wanted to reign and all that fun stuff. Luckily, he had a good sister, Jehosheba. Yeah, and she was actually married to the priest, the head priest at the time, Jehoiada, I guess, right? And Joash, for the first beginning of his life, was stolen away and from the room of all the grandkids right before they were about to get slaughtered. So Jehosheba took him off, and held on to him for six years until he was seven. And when it became seven, they became Jehoiada, who during the time of Joash, you kind of had to picture Jehoiada as the conduit through God, through which God is kind of leading the country. And I'll get to the point of why in a second. Just Joash, though, on that little map of good people and good then evil, he was kind of the good then evil kind of guy. Well, I kind of pictured him as always not really good, but it will get there. He was kind of raised by Jehoiada, and at the age of seven, they had the coup, killed off Athaliah, and it didn't really say much about his life. It just kind of jumps right to it. Again, Kings and Chronicles talks about him, and the one great thing he did was repaired the temple. Well, if you were raised in a temple, you're just kind of sick of it being crap, you know. You're going to want to repair your home too, right? So he went and he got Jehoiada, and he got all the Levites to kind of get them to gather money, which I'm not too sure what happened, but he had them gather all the money. Apparently there was no money left over in any of the temples because Athaliah, her sons, robbed it.
And it was
stole it blind.
It was set down from Moses that
right.
The Levites should gather this money for the temple maintenance.
Yeah, and so the money ended up not being there. It goes through this whole thing of him outlining his command to go grab that money. I guess they're just kind of making the point that Athaliah had taken the money to make her look worse. So Joash is like, well, do something about it. Get more money. And so I guess kind of the tithings were collected in a chest with a hole in top. And they outlined that too for some reason. Where everybody, whenever it was full, kind of went through a process of keeping an account of all the money that came in, keeping an account of the structure that kind of put together the temple. And so they did it in a very right, well-organized way of rebuilding the temple. That was a good thing that he did that. And that was under the hand of Jehoiada. He kind of made it, saw it through. He handled everything. Well, Jehoiada ended up dying, and he was very honored funeral. But after, right after, pretty much, it kind of talks about how they had given him his funeral. People go off, and then they just kind of don't do anything good anymore, and it doesn't say anything directly about Joash doing anything bad per se, but it doesn't say anything that he was leading them anywhere. So, like they were saying before, as the king does, the people do. It was, the Bible kind of gives an account of what the people were doing rather than how the king was acting. So, by the as his conduit to God left, so did his connection to God. So he's not going to be following God anymore. Joash, after that point, he gets Jehoiada and Josheba had Zechariah. Zechariah's his son. He becomes the new kind of head priest kind of guy. It's his cousin. Keep that in mind. This kind of puts Joash not too far from Athaliah. Zechariah comes and says, "What are you doing? Go back to following God. Go follow God." Well, Joash, I guess, also kind of influenced by the other people at the time, kill off, have him stoned. It says by orders of the king. It doesn't say Joash directly, it just says by order of the king. Kill off Zechariah. They stone him to death. And as he's dying, he says, let me see here. Oh, is that there? Basically, heck with you. Kind of thing, may God curse you. And that was it. A year later, he starts getting attacked by other kings. Joash gets really hurt and won the first battles. And then the second time, they start getting attacked by a small army, which kind of puts emphasis on the fact that he wasn't connected to God anymore. Takes over Jerusalem. And to kind of keep them from killing him and saving his country, he goes and loots the temple, pretty much. So he takes all the money that all his fathers and he had put in the temple and gives it off kind of as bribery. Of course, that just kind of makes him no better than anyone else. He looted, loot, what is the word? Stole, looted, yeah. And after that, of course, as his nation was falling, the nation fell, and that means bad leaders came up. His council killed him off. And that is basically what happened. They gave him a burial. It wasn't like they disrespected him after he was dead. They still buried him in the city of David. They buried him well. And his son became king. They just didn't want him being king anymore. So that was kind of his deal, is that Joash really was only doing things kind of, I guess, as I kind of saw it and as it was kind of put in the comments here in the Bible, it was Jehoiada was his leader. He was following Jehoiada. As soon as Jehoiada died, he became what he really was, which is someone who cared only about himself and maybe not really sure where he stood because he lost that connection to God. So he was gone.
Thank you, Steve. Okay. One of the things that kind of interested as I sit here and listen was what Ed said in relationship to what Stephen said. When Ed did his with Jehoshaphat, he was the son of Asa. And Asa was a great godly man who the last 3 years actually co-reigned with his son Jehoshaphat and trained him and brought him along. Whereas we hear from Jehoiada, we didn't seem to quite hear that same sort of thing. And as a result, when he was gone, then we didn't get the kind of leadership that we normally would. So the next one we have after that is we're going to skip one king, Amaziah, and we're going to go down to Uzziah. Uzziah? Okay. Who knows? I'm from Palestine, Texas.
That's okay. I don't think anybody in here knows the right pronunciation anyway. So the name is King Uzziah, and he's also known as Azariah. You'll hear him mostly as Azariah in Kings and Uzziah in Chronicles. The thinking there is that Azariah is his birth name. Uzziah was his throne name. Azariah is a really popular name in the Bible. You see it all over the place. Abednego was an Azariah, right? He was renamed by Nebuchadnezzar. Interesting is that he's also referred to once in the New Testament as Ozias. So there's a third name for this guy. But he's only done so with the KJV. In the chronology that Matthew gives, the lineages, he talks about, and Josaphat begat Joram, Joram begat Ozias. In the NIV, it renders it as Uzziah. Just so little Bible trivia there, so you don't get stumped at a party or anything. So Uzziah was one of the very, very few good kings. He was a good king. He had some great things going for him in his reign. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. He started his reign at the age of 16. He reigned for 52 years. This is the longest reign of any of the kings, except for Manasseh, who reigned for 55 years. He was one of the worst kings. Yeah, yeah. In fact, I think maybe he's
other than Ahaz, maybe Ahaz.
Bad king, bad guy. Okay. So during this guy's reign, he saw a lot of stuff going on. Isaiah was active, Hosea, Amos, all three of these prophets, maybe even Joel, although there's some speculation, uncertainty as to when exactly Joel was prophesying. In the northern kingdom, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, he saw 6 different kings in the northern kingdom during his reign. So there's a lot going on during the time of Uzziah. It was a time of really great prosperity. I mean, similar even to the reign of King Solomon. A lot going on. Judah was out there in great force. Uzziah was a great military leader. He had a lot of conquests. He went in. There's not much that's given on Uzziah. I've got about 3 or 4 sentences in Kings, and then maybe about 10 or 12 in Chronicles. But what it talks about mostly in those little passages are his military conquests. He goes in and he takes over some Philistine towns. He broke down the walls of Gath, Jabneh, big city. Ashdod, we've heard about those cities. We know what they are. Goliath was from Gath. King Achish, when David went and acted like a madman in front of King Achish. He is known for significantly fortifying Jerusalem. He built these machines. They're noted as machines from which were thrown spears and stones. But what's interesting is that catapults, I mean, your mind thinks of a catapult-type machine, but catapults weren't known on the scene for several hundred years. So what these machines were is a bit unknown. I mean, maybe Uzziah invented the catapult, and then the technology was lost somehow, and then it was reinvented several hundred, who knows. But anyway, there's speculation that these machines were really just defensive armor from behind which the defenders would shoot arrows and toss stones. They weren't necessarily catapults, but they're translated in the Bible as war machines. He's known for building towers and bastions. He built towers at the corners of the walls in Jerusalem from which these machines would cast their arrows and stones. And he also built these towers out in the wilderness. And he built a lot of cisterns and wells out in the wilderness, which I think is interesting because a lot of the other kings we've learned that they caved all these in so that they wouldn't be of service to any invaders. It shows Uzziah's confidence and his military prowess. He had 2,600 officers and 307,500 fighting men who could wage war with mighty power. He was noted for having provided shields, spears, helmets, coats of armor, bows, and sling stones for the entire army. I mean, this is, if you look at one of our little pictures that we had of the poor little Israel showing up with sticks and stones, right? This is a whole different scene. He rebuilt Elath. This is a city on the coast of the Red Sea. It was a very strategic point. He captured that city and rebuilt it, which gave him trade throughout the area, Arabia, Africa, India. This is a city that trades hands a lot in the Bible. Well, it was under his control during his reign. Big city to be able to control. He's also noted as not having removed the high places. So people were still worshiping at the high places. And King Uzziah is most well known
for his downfall. Although he's recognized as a good king, he's most well known for his downfall. And I'm wondering if anybody knows what his downfall was. Any ideas? Okay, if I tell you, you'll remember that this guy is known for having going and offering incense. Okay? All right, and then he gets struck with leprosy. But what's interesting, you know the story? Okay. I wanted to put somebody, jumping Jehoshaphat. I wanted to put somebody on the spot because the way I knew this king, or the way he's popularly known as the guy who offered incense before the Lord and was struck with leprosy for having done so, right? But he really didn't get that far. He went in to offer incense to the Lord, but he was confronted by the chief priest, whose name was Azariah, and 80 others, who said it wasn't right for him to do so. And he went into a rage. He didn't do it. He didn't carry through with the act. The reason he was struck with leprosy was because he went into a rage with the priests in the temple. And that's when he was struck with leprosy. So
it's the rage.
It was the rage, okay? It was the defiance. And it was not the fact that he had offered incense, which I thought was a little bit interesting.
Did he even go in the temple? Was he consecrated to be able to go in there? Maybe that was why.
I would think maybe he wasn't allowed to go in, himself. Yeah.
And it was the rage came from pride. Okay, he was very proud of all his accomplishments and good report though. I mean, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, in fact, I'll read a little bit of this. But after Uzziah became powerful, which he was, his pride led to his downfall. He was unfaithful to the Lord his God and entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. Azariah the priest, with 80 other courageous priests of the Lord, followed him in. They confronted him and said, "It is not right for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord. That is for the priests, the descendants of Aaron, who have been consecrated to burn incense. Leave the sanctuary, for you have been unfaithful, and you will not be honored by the Lord your God." Uzziah had a censer in his hand ready to burn incense. He became angry while he was raging at the priests in their presence before the incense altar in the Lord's temple. Leprosy broke out on his forehead. And it goes on to say that he then spends the rest of his reign in a separated house, and his son Jotham takes over the governorship until King Uzziah dies, and then Jotham becomes king. So, just some interesting connections. Uzziah gets off the hook easy, really. Because if you remember Nadab and Abihu, Aaron's sons, they did offer incense before the Lord unceremoniously. And they were struck with fire and killed on the spot, right? They were torched. That's right. And then there's also Korah's rebellion. There's an interesting scene there, Korah's rebellion. His men are told to stand outside the temple with incense in their censers. And then we know the story. God swallows them up in an earthquake, essentially, swallows them whole. And then he instructs Moses to go and collect the censers from the smoldering ashes, take the censers, and plate the altar with them. So that's, okay? So he says, hammer the censers into sheets to overlay the altar, for they were presented before the Lord and have become holy. Let them be a sign to the Israelites. So maybe the first golden post-it notes, you know, that King Uzziah, you know, there is a reminder as a sign, and King Uzziah kind of missed that whole deal there and forgot about the significance of offering incense before the Lord. Now, the big offense, what is the big offense? I mean, is God so concerned about his holy things that he would strike you dead if you mishandled them? Is that the offense? I mean, we have the example of the ark, right? We have the example where for even touching the ark, people were struck dead. But in the case of these holy things, and I'm going to talk about the ark in a second, God offers... He offers atonement for his holy things. He says, The Lord said to Moses, this is Leviticus 5:14-16. The Lord said to Moses, when a person commits a violation and sins unintentionally in regard to any of the Lord's holy things, he is to bring the Lord as a penalty. And he goes, what is supposed to be brought to offer restitution? He must make restitution for what he has failed to do in regard to the holy thing. So you mishandle the holy thing. God's not going to strike you dead. All right, you made a mistake. And if you do so, here's what you must do to offer restitution. So none of these indictments against these men were because they mishandled the holy things. In each case, it was a matter of pride, right? Uzziah, definite pride. Nadab and Abihu, pride. Korah's rebellion, pride. All of it was an issue of pride. Now, the ark, those men touching the ark and being struck, well, even David got kind of bent out of shape about that happened. It seemed a little severe, but I might offer that the ark shouldn't have ever been out of the temple in the first place, right? And maybe that's why God was a little upset about it. Okay, so Uzziah got off pretty easy, I think. The only other information that is offered in the Bible about Uzziah, there's a couple of mentions in Amos and Zechariah, and also in Isaiah. In Amos and Zechariah, they talk about an earthquake that occurs during the time of Uzziah. The words of Amos, one of the shepherds of Tekoa, what he saw concerning Israel 2 years before the earthquake when Uzziah was king of Judah. So there's this big earthquake. There's a lot of mentions of earthquakes in the Bible. Zechariah 14:5, you will flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. So there's this big earthquake during the time of Uzziah. The Palestine, I did a little research on earthquakes in the Bible. Palestine, that whole area there, is right next to the African Rift Zone, which is the deepest crack in the Earth's crust. And so that's, you know, it's not unusual to have earthquakes there. We see a lot of mentions of earthquakes in the Bible. I'm going to go extra biblical for a second here. Josephus makes mention of Uzziah, which I think is interesting and worth a moment. Okay. I will refrain from reading this whole thing. Let me find a good starting point. And when they cried out that he must not go out of the temple and not transgress against God, he was wroth at them and threatened to kill them unless they withhold their peace. In the meantime, a great earthquake shook the ground and a rent was made in the temple, and the bright rays of the sun shone through it and fell upon the king's face, insomuch that the leprosy seized upon him immediately. And before the city, at a place called Erog, half the mountain broke off from the rest of on the west and rolled itself 4 furlongs and stood still at the east mountain till the roads as well as the king's gardens were spoiled by the obstruction. Okay, so Josephus makes note of this earthquake that is also made mention of in Amos and Zechariah. And Josephus is connecting the earthquake with God's punishment, or, you know, God's enactment of the leprosy on King Uzziah's forehead there. Interesting connection, I think. Extra biblical, so don't run off with it as absolute truth. But it is Josephus. He's often referenced. Okay, I'm almost done. Got to mention Isaiah, okay? Now, this guy Isaiah, if you look on your little charts there, it doesn't show that he starts prophesying until after Uzziah, but he's noted as being the recorder during the time of Uzziah, and I might even think that he was in the temple at the time. Isaiah has one of his better known chapters, chapter 6, okay? He mentions Uzziah. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. You all recognize this chapter. There's a lot in here that you'll recognize. Above him were seraphs, each with 6 wings. With 2 wings covered their faces, and with 2 they covered their feet, and with 2 they were flying, and they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy is the Lord Almighty, the earth is full of his glory." You recognize that. So the point being is that Isaiah is about to get his calling here in chapter 6. And he mentions an earthquake as well. So you know what connection I'm wanting to make here, right? Isaiah is in the temple at the time that Uzziah is getting his leprosy here. At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. Okay? Earthquakes, we read over that kind of stuff, but what else is causing that but an earthquake, right? So Isaiah is noting an earthquake, and then he says, I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? And I said, here I am, send me. You all know that. But anyway, the connection that I'm wanting to make, and I don't find a commentary that's with me on this, so again, I'm kind of going extra biblical and wanting to bend and twist and turn a little bit, but it's fun to do, so hang with me. Anyway, I'm done. One interesting thing I think extra-biblical is that there has been an epitaph found in 1931 that reads, it reads, hither were brought the bones of Uzziah, king of Judah, do not open. They found this in Jerusalem. So... yeah, well, it was just the epitaph, you know. So, anyway, that's it. That's fine.
Uzziah.
So, what was Uzziah known for?
Pride.
Pride.
For his leprosy. The story of the incense. The thing as we study these and as we look at these, I do think that it's real interesting to tie a lot of these references together. Be careful though.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah,
be
yeah.
Careful with trying to put something that's not there.
It could have lots of warnings.
It could be. The thing I love about Bethel is we talk about what it does say. Okay, and we recognize that it doesn't say a lot of things as well. We have the warnings. Good report. The next one we're going to do, we're going to skip down a little bit, and we're going to do Manasseh, and that would be coming from Renee.
I have 12 handouts, but I don't think it's going to be enough. So, just, I guess, pass 12 up from there. Okay, I have the big daddy of this, I guess, of the southern tribes. He was from the house of David. His father was Hezekiah, who actually did some good in that he walked with God and did a lot of reforms. Manasseh was actually born in that 15-year cycle after Hezekiah was supposed to die, and he prayed and kind of repented, and the Lord said, okay, I'll give you 15 more years. Well, Manasseh was born within that 15-year time, and some people were saying, you know, it probably would have been better had Hezekiah not had those extra 15 years and Manasseh had never been born. That was the kind of king he was. He was 12 when he became king. He actually reigned for 55 years, which makes him the longest reigning king of Judah. He is probably considered the most evil of the southern kings, and he is often compared to Ahab as being, you know, he's as worse as Ahab, if not worse than Ahab, in some of the things that he was doing. He is also credited with killing Isaiah, although that's still questionable, but during his time, tradition holds that he was the one that actually ordered that Isaiah be sawed in half during that time. And the two prophets that were active during his time were Isaiah and Micah. When Manasseh came on the scene, he started out with major problems. And one of the first things he did is he did not follow in his father's footsteps. So all the reforms that Hezekiah had come up with, Manasseh just wiped them off the face of the scene. He actually put back up altars to Baal. He put back up Asherah poles. And I left the Bible references there to you. He's mentioned in 2 Kings and in 2 Chronicles. He built altars for Baal and other gods. He sometime is noted, as I said, in connection with Ahab, and sometimes they will call him kind of like followers of the calf in some of his practices. Sexual immorality was a big thing for his reign. It was all over the place. He also participated in the rites of the Canaanites, especially child sacrifices. His oldest son was sacrificed to the god of fire, which I think was Molech. He participated in witchcraft and with seers, and people also connecting with satanic arts, different satanic arts. And they believe he also was a star, sun, and moon worshiper. Now, I don't know if he like worshiped the planets, but I mean, I can see like he could be like a magi, but I don't think that was the take that he was going on. I think it was the fact that he was holding them as gods. But I couldn't find really anything to substantiate that. In addition to all that, he actually is seen as one who encouraged his people to revolt against God. And if you didn't revolt against God with him or walk away from God with him, then he would persecute you. And again, that goes back to Isaiah. In the Bible, it talks about blood being spilled from one end of Judah to the other. So those that didn't follow the practices that he was having with his government, they often were put to the sword. The Lord basically, because of Manasseh and his reign, it said that he said that the people of Israel, of Judah, had fallen into more sin than the people who were there before them, the Canaanites, the people that he had already run out. In other words, the Israelites were far worse than those people had ever been, and that he was going to allow punishment to happen. And the Assyrians came in and conquered Judah at this time. And actually, there's some references that Manasseh was bound and taken to their capital and had an exile. And it said to Babylon, but this isn't the captivity. This isn't the last of it. So this is the first one. This isn't the last one. But during that time, Manasseh apparently, I was doing some reading on things that they would do, especially to the leaders that were in exile, and apparently it was a pretty nasty torture what they did to him. And during that time, he decided maybe, you know, it wasn't such a bad deal, and he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord actually heard his cry of repentance. Let's see, wait a minute. I missed a spot here. There are some people, and I took this from the Concordia Self-Study Bible. It's on this page in chapter 33:11. It was talking about that some people believe that Manasseh was actually allowed to go back to become a vassal of the Assyrians. And whether that has been substantiated or not, they're not for sure. But that Manasseh, you know, God allowed him to come back to Israel, but when he did, he still was under the Assyrians. While he was there, he had a change of heart. He decided that that he would repent and ask God for repentance. And what I've given you on the second to the last page is the purported prayer of Manasseh. And this may or may not be the prayer of Manasseh. This is actually taken from the Apocrypha. So if you've read any of those. Whether or not these were his exact words, they do not know, but they believe that this was the intent of his prayer of repentance. And it is actually talked about in, I believe, Second Chronicles. It's either in the Kings or the Chronicles passage where it talks about he prayed to the Lord. And so this, I didn't know if you guys had ever seen it, so that's why I put it in here so you could take through and read through it. But he did come back to Judah. And when he was there, he did restore the temple. He did rebuild and refortify the cities. He did take away the altars. He had actually gotten so bold as to put an altar to Baal and an Asherah pole inside the temple of the Lord. That was how bold he got at one point. And so he had that removed. He went and encouraged the people to not sacrifice any longer at the high places. He didn't get rid of the high places, but the people, when they were sacrificing, sacrificed only to the Lord and not to Baal after that. He did command all of Judah to worship God alone. And so towards the end, he did show a little sign of repentance. However, that does not hold true for his son who follows later on. He was succeeded by his son Ammon. He was one of the five, it said he was one of the five kings that was not buried in the palace of the kings. He was actually buried in his gardens, in his palace. Let's see. I think that was it. I probably missed a lot, but okay. Did I miss a lot?
No, you did good.
Okay.
We have. Let's see. The order of these was. We had Hezekiah, which Michael told us about last week, who was one of the best. Okay, with all the reforms. Well, one of the reasons he was considered the best is because he followed Ahaz, which was maybe the worst, you know, of all of them. He brought Baal in for the first time into the south and worshipped and everything, and Hezekiah did all the reforms to get rid of that. Keep in mind, Ahaz and Manasseh would have been grandfather and grandson, so there were still ties here, okay? And so there was influences, not just generation to generation. And then we had Ammon, who continued in the ways of Manasseh. And then after that, we had Josiah. And Gary's going to tell us about him.
I'm going to try and concentrate on some of the cargo from the story. And therefore, I'm not going to give out the handout, which is the vehicles and the events of the life, until after the talk. Basically, Manasseh, in the very last years, was a good guy, as she has told us. And at this point, Josiah was born, and he was alive during the last 6 years of Manasseh's life. And he saw the good stuff. He saw probably some of the bad stuff, but he probably didn't remember that because the good stuff occurred in the last couple of years in Manasseh's life. Then Ammon, his father, became king. And he returned to the bad ways of Manasseh. So Josiah saw not only the good of Manasseh, but the bad of his father Ammon. And he became king at the age of 8. He became king because Ammon's servants decided to have him assassinated. But the people wanted order and not such rebellion. So they ordered the people that had killed Ammon killed. So they took over and appointed Josiah to take over as king at the age of 8. Well, who at the age of 8 is going to be a good king? But he was lucky. He had good advisors that took care of things for him for the first few years. He actually was born in 648 BC. He became king in 640. And he began to seek the Lord. Was it after he'd been king for 8 years or 16? 4 more years, he began to become very active at purging the land of idols and idolatry. Then it went on for another few years, and in the 18th year of his reign, he ordered the repair of the temple. And so then he had the monies that had been collected distributed to the people who would be rebuilding the temple. And in the process of rebuilding, the high priest found a book of the law. It may have been Deuteronomy. It may have been all of the Pentateuch. But he brought it and had this scribe read it to the king. And Josiah realized, we's in bad trouble. We ain't been doing things the way God wants us to. So he decided to change things suddenly, and he called all the people together, and after he made a covenant, the people also made a covenant, and then at this point, Josiah was very active in tearing down temple or tearing down the altars and Asherah poles and getting rid of the people who were worshiping other gods and all of this. And in the last few years of his life, there were Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that would be taken off by under Nebuchadnezzar, and they would do their thing later. But they're in the first 11 years of their life, they were under Josiah the king and learned how to be good followers of God at that time. The Josiah made a mistake. And as the king or Pharaoh of Egypt was going to go on and take on his enemy, the king of Babylon, in an alliance with Assyria, Josiah thought, this isn't a good thing. I'm going to stop it. There is no record of him inquiring of the Lord to do this. And so some think that he was killed as an act of punishment for not inquiring of the Lord, but making this decision on his own. He died, not in battle, but was wounded mortally, taken back, and then died. He was mourned by all the people and was succeeded by three of his sons and somebody else. One son succeeded him for 3 months. The king of Egypt, or Pharaoh of Egypt, replaced him with another of Josiah's sons and changed his name to Joachim. And then Joachim's son took over for several years, and after that was replaced by his uncle, which would be the third of Josiah's sons. And so, actually, the important thing to remember is that he always sought to seek the way of the Lord and follow the Lord. What we can learn from this is, like him, to inquire of the word of the God, of the Lord. Taking Bethel is a good way to do that. Then to become active in doing the things that God would have us do. And finally, because we can't do it on our own, to pray to God for the strength to be able to carry this out. And the handout I'm going to give you came directly out of a book, Following God, Life Principles from the Kings of the Old Testament. And the biblical sources for most of the events are 2 Kings chapters 21 through 23 and 2 Chronicles 34 through 35. 2 Kings only points out Manasseh as being a bad guy. Only in Chronicles do you find out that at the end he turned around and did some good things. And yes, the handout is directly copied out of that book. It's the events, but it also gives the year of the event and the biblical reference for each of these things. And are there any questions?
Good report.
I have a question. So sure. These last three guys were all from Josiah, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin.
Mm-hmm.
Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
so we don't
by
have
that point in time, too, they were being attacked pretty good by Babylon. We'll learn all that in a couple of weeks. You'll hear.
So we don't have the son of Jehoiakim on this list. Is that...
There's Jehoiaz and then Jehoiakim. That was a changed name from the Egyptian king, changed the name of Eliakim or something. And then there was a Jehoiachin, his son, and then it went back to Zedekiah.
So Zedekiah's the uncle?
We're going to hear now who Zedekiah was as we hear our last report, and we're going to get this in before 9:30.
So it's a good thing I didn't go home.
Yeah.
Come back, right?
Or you so it's close, though. It's close. And Deb's going to give us a report on Zedekiah, who was the last king.
Well, good evening. I am Mattaniahu.
Who?
Mattaniahu, which means gift of God. I am the third son of the revered King Josiah, who reigned for 31 years in Judah. My mother is Hamaltal, daughter of Jeremiah of Libna, but this was not Jeremiah the prophet. My older brother, Jehoahaz, became king after our father Josiah was killed by Pharaoh Necho of Egypt. But in his short three-month reign, he did not honor God. Next, my brother, Eliakim, you probably know him as Jehoiakim, reigned over Judah for 11 years. Well, he too didn't follow in my father's godly footsteps. Then my nephew, Jehoiachin, Jehoiakim's son, became king. But guess what? He didn't follow in godly footsteps either. So he didn't last very long at all. So at long last, I am finally chosen king by Nebuchadnezzar II. What a powerful position for this 21-year-old boy. Wouldn't you agree? However, since my uncle and my nephew both rebelled against the Babylonian rule, Nebuchadnezzar forced me to swear a binding oath to the Lord that my rule of Judah would be in full submission to the Babylonian Empire. Well, fine. What's wrong with that? As long as I get to be king, what's wrong with showing allegiance to and the tolerance of a powerful people who worship other gods or have other convictions than our Lord? But wait, I'm getting ahead of myself. As is the custom, a special throne name is given to me, and that's when I become Zedekiah, which means Jehovah is my righteousness and justice of Jehovah. My new name reflects my significant character traits of desiring divine justice and righteousness. But soon, I learn that there is so much more to exhibiting godly character than simply changing my name. Do you know that righteousness demands that I follow the Lord with all my heart, and that I walk in all of his ways and follow all of his commands, that isn't an easy thing to do, mind you. Well, obviously, my reign will not earn me strong marks in those categories. God had sent different prophets to Judah during my childhood. I had heard about Daniel. I had heard from Ezekiel. I had heard about Jeremiah. They all prophesied about our country. Listen to what Ezekiel said when Jehoiakim was king. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. This oracle concerns the prince of Jerusalem and the whole house of Israel who are there. Say to them, I am assigned to you. As I have done, so it will be done to them. They will go into exile as captives. The prince among them will put his things on his shoulder at dusk and leave, and a hole will be dug in the wall for him to go through. He will cover his face so he cannot see the land. I will spread my net for him, and he will be caught in my snare. I will bring him to Babylon, the land of the Chaldeans, but he will not see it, and there he will die. I will scatter to the winds all those around him, his staff and all his troops, and I will pursue them with drawn sword. They will know that I am the Lord when I disperse them among the nations and scatter them through the countries. But I will spare a few of them from the sword, famine, and plague, so that in the nations where they go, they may acknowledge all their detestable practices. Then they will know that I am the Lord. Well, I suppose that that must have been meant for Jehoiakim and Jehoiachin, because the Babylonians had laid siege to Jerusalem, and they had carted off King Jehoiachin, his wives, his mother, his attendants, his nobles, and his officials. They had stripped the temple of its treasures and gold, as well as the treasures of the royal palace. They had forced 10,000 of our strongest warriors and finest craftsmen and artisans out of Jerusalem and into Babylon. I am left with only the poor citizens and the prophet Jeremiah. Well, as king, I asked Jeremiah to please pray to the Lord, our God, for us. Well, he would tell me that what I needed to do is what was just and what was right. Or he'd tell me that my officials and I are like inedible figs, abhorrent and an offense to all the kingdoms of the earth. Well, Jeremiah quickly became a thorn in my side. Here's what he said to the kings of Edom, Moab, Ammon, Tyre, and Sidon, as well as our priests in Judah, and also to me. This is Jeremiah speaking. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Tell this to your master. With my great power and outstretched arm, I made the earth and its people and the animals that are on it, and I give it to anyone I please. Now I will hand all your countries over to my servant, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. I will make even the wild animals subject to him and his son and his grandson until the time for his land comes. Then many nations and great kings will subjugate him. If, however, any nation or kingdom will not serve Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, or bow its neck under his yoke, I will punish that nation with the sword, famine, and plague, declares the Lord, until I destroy it by his hand. So do not listen to your prophets, to your diviners, your interpreters of dreams, your mediums, or your sorcerers, who tell you, you will not serve the king of Babylon, because I have not sent them, says the Lord. They prophesy lies to you that will only serve to remove you far from your lands. I will banish you and you will perish. But if any nation will bow its neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon and serve him, I will let that nation remain in its own land to till it and to live there, declares the Lord. Oh, Jeremiah. You know, throughout my reign, he continued to just prophesy that doom and that gloom. Honest to goodness. I mean, even in my fourth year, we traveled together to Babylon in order to reassure King Nebuchadnezzar that I was holding to the oath that I made to the Lord. But Jeremiah once again pulled out his scroll and read those words of doom and gloom. And then promptly he tied a stone to that scroll and threw it in the Euphrates River, exclaiming, "So will Babylon sink to rise no more because of the disaster I will bring upon her, and her people will fail." What a crackpot! Prophesying that the great kingdom of Babylon would fall? He must have been nuts. But in the midst of all Jeremiah's naysaying, I learned that King Hophra of Egypt was making great plans to conquer the Babylonians and the lands leading to Asia. Well, I was tired of being Nebuchadnezzar's puppet, so I forged an alliance with King Hophra. Again, Jeremiah warned me against such action, but I was king. I didn't have to humble myself to a prophet. Besides, the people seemed to be doing okay, practicing whatever religious customs they felt comfortable with, rather than adhering to the stricter practices of Yahweh. Well, when King Nebuchadnezzar learned that I broke my oath to the Lord, severing my alliance with Babylon, he became absolutely furious, and he personally led his army into a siege against Jerusalem. This siege began during my 11th year and lasted for 3 very long, hot summers. Thankfully, though, I had the alliance with Egypt. Surely they would defeat the Babylonians and rescue us. Of course, here's Jeremiah still bombarding my people with all of his doom and his gloom. I just couldn't take it anymore. And so I had him imprisoned in the guard house within the royal palace. You know, Jeremiah, he actually told me that God was about to hand over Jerusalem to the king of Babylon and that I would not escape out of the hands of the Babylonians, that I would slip through the city walls at night, fleeing Jerusalem like a coward. I wasn't a coward. He went on to tell me I would see King Nebuchadnezzar with my own eyes and speak face to face with him, that I would not die by the sword, but die peacefully. Where had I heard that before? Wasn't that what Ezekiel had prophesied earlier? However, by now I had become very stiff-necked and hard-hearted, and I refused to accept Jeremiah's prophecies from the Lord and repent. So that long siege continued, and it depleted our food and water supplies. In my 11th year of my reign, we finally realized that the Egyptians had been routed by the Babylonians. In desperation, we broke through the city wall at night and fled towards Araba. Unfortunately, the Babylonian army overtook us on the plains of Jericho. My soldiers were separated from me and scattered. My sons and I were captured and taken to Riblah north of Damascus, where Nebuchadnezzar sentenced us. My sons, they were only little boys. They were dragged one by one and killed right before my eyes. Then I had my own eyes gouged out. I was bound in shackles and taken to Babylon, where I languished in prison the rest of my torturous days. There I heard that the temple was destroyed and all of Jerusalem burned. Oh Lord, what happened to your Ark of the Covenant? I also heard that only a very small number of our poorest and most powerless people were left to work the vineyards and the fields so that they wouldn't become overgrown. We'd been exiled from the promised land, and that land would now enjoy its Sabbath rest for 70 years, thus completing the fulfillment of the Lord's word through Jeremiah. And why? Not because I rebelled simply against an earthly king, but because I rebelled against the greatest king of kings, Jehovah. That is why I'll always be known as a wicked an evil king.
Scroll gets
there. Yeah. Brought tears to my eyes thinking, you know, that his kids, I mean, they wouldn't have been any older than 10 years old.
Yeah.
You know, his sons were killed in front of him.
And that's the last thing he saw. Sad story. The reports were great. They really were. And I know we give praise for lavishly, but it really was. The work that you did on these things, the extra work that you did, going looking at the extra sources and whatever, because some of you didn't have very much, and going to the other scriptures and finding stories that were relevant and that did that.
Josephus
right.
Is biblical, right?
What's that?
Yeah. Josephus is biblical.
Yeah. Great relevance to what we're going to discuss the next 2 weeks. It really was. It was, I'm glad we recorded it so Kurt will get to hear it. Yeah, I think he'll enjoy it a great deal. So, good job. Give yourselves a hand, really. I'll applaud you. Great job. We've got some assignments for you, and if you'll let me close with a word of prayer. Next week we will do the study of the North, how it crumbled, and we will have Deb do the picture of the recalling of destiny, and Karen will give us a extra assignment on the prophets. Let's close. Dear Lord, we just thank you for being here with us tonight as we're gathered in your name. We thank you for these wonderful stories to remind us how important it is to seek of you, what guidance and what your will would be in our lives for whatever we do, no matter how great or how small, and how important it is that we make those decisions based on what your will is, and that we learn and grow to be able to really listen to you and to hear what you would have. Convict us, Lord, as we go forward. And we pray these things along with the prayer request that's been listed on the sheet. And we pray it all in your name. Amen.